Succession number 28361, reel 26.
General Julian Thompson, reel 26.
When you first started your studies and exercises up in the northern flank, did you have the Dutch battalion attached to the commando brigade?
They joined us after I'd been in the job for about 3 or 4 months, I would guess. And it started with a company being attached to 45 commando in Arbroath called W Company.
Right.
W because the other companies are X, Y and Z. Mm-hmm. And they slipped into that. They became W. And then a memorandum of understanding was signed between the Royal Marines and the Netherlands Marines, which was that they would put a battalion under command of the commando brigade. And this was a sort of quite a crafty move, really, because both organizations were under threat, and a way of sort of fending the threat off was that if you disband us, of course you'll affect those people across there, and it'd be bad for NATO and bad for all those sort of things.
Political repercussions.
Political repercussions. So that was the purpose of it. And the first exercise they joined us for was an exercise in Norway, part of them joined us, an exercise in Norway in the September, October of 1973. Mm. And then they sent the whole battalion over to England, to Salisbury Plain, because they had been working very much on American lines, because the history of the Dutch Marines is that in the Second World War, they were going to have a battalion or a regiment or something as part of the operations in the Pacific under the American command. So they adopted American procedures. They looked like Americans when you saw them. They wore American-type uniforms and they had American ideas. And they realized they were going to have to come to our way of thinking if they were going to be under our command. And of course, all orders to them were given in English. And they even held their own O groups in English when they were doing it unilaterally. So they came to Salisbury Plain, and as brigade major, I then ran an exercise which lasted a week, where I put them through their paces in all phases of war. And it was totally a instructional exercise where you stopped and said, right, no, we'll do that again because you've got that wrong.
You were indoctrinating him in British tactics.
Exactly.
British infantry?
British infantry. I mean, the Royal Marines use British infantry tactics.
It's the same as they were teaching at School of Infantry.
Indeed, and I'll let thereby hangs a tale. Because after the first 24 hours, it became quite apparent to me that they were pretty badly trained, even in American tactics, because they did so little collective training that their officers hadn't a clue how to conduct a withdrawal, for example, or how to conduct an advanced contact. They hadn't the slightest idea. So I said, stop. I then sent my G3 into Warminster, and I said, go and find the Royal Marine DS on the School of Infantry. I want 5 copies of the Infantry Battalion in Battle, which was just being rewritten, actually.
Yes.
So 5 copies of the Infantry Battalion in Battle were brought hot foot by my G3. I gave it to the Dutch. I said, there's now a 24-hour break. You'll read this pamphlet, and we'll start again. And you may have this pamphlet by you while we do these various things, which will be done in slow time. And there was an enemy, a token enemy.
Did you provide the enemy?
No, they actually provided their whiskey company, W Company, from Scotland, came down and went in. So that was a good thing, too. So you had Dutchman against Dutchman. And there was no sort of...
Yes.
You didn't have, sort of people trying to score points off each other.
Mm.
The whiskey company being an independent company, of course, naturally tried to score points off this battalion.
Had whiskey been given the treatment and been integrated?
Well, I don't know how that had happened, because they had been with 4-5 Commando before I took over as brigade major, so I'm not quite sure what they did to them.
Mm.
I have no idea. Anyway, we had this week of exercises, and I think it was quite successful.
How did they take to being told, you're doing this wrong, read the pamphlet,
do it again?
They didn't mind.
No, they wanted to get it right. Oh. I mean, one had to do it terribly tactfully. Mm-hmm. But we realised they didn't understand how to do anything. I mean, one of the first exercises I gave them, because it was nice and static and they could get into it, was a demolition guard of the River Avon crossing Charlie, mm-hmm. which they would then withdraw to another position. And you know, I said to them, you know, this is what you do when your second 11 will go back and recce the new position. They said, what do you mean by that? Mm. And I said, well, your second team goes back and recce the new position, and your two ICs all go back and recce the new position, you stay here.
So they weren't familiar with the language.
They were not familiar with the language or the modus operandi. Oh, their collective tradition was in ships attachments at sea, or small unit operations elsewhere doing other things.
They had some tradition of raiding, didn't they? They
had
World War?
A little. I can't remember how much raiding they did. They'd done quite a lot of their most recent operational experience had been in Dutch New Guinea, in counterinsurgency, the Netherlands Marines. But their techniques for sort of what I would call conventional war were pretty shaky. Mm. And it worked out. The only thing they did wrong in the end, actually, was because they were copying everything we did. I suddenly realised that they were copying brigade headquarters as a battalion headquarters.
Ah. Oh.
So they replicated it down one size. But it was too big. Mm. It had all the wrong sort of people in it, you know. And it was they did that, and I didn't stop them doing it. I mean, I wasn't in time to stop them, because I didn't realise what they were doing until I suddenly realised they were sort of running around brigade headquarters taking notes. Mm-hmm. And then when I next saw them, there was this sort of miniature version of this, and I said, oh, that's not quite right, you don't want that. Anyway, that's what they did. So that was the introduction of the Dutch Marine connection. Of course, and then I had them when I was brigade commander, I had them under command later. Mm. They were very good, actually.
How long did their Marines serve? Were they conscripts?
Well, they had a combination of regulars and conscripts, and I can't remember what the proportion was, but it was, I think it was mainly conscripts, but they had quite a lot of regulars. I think they had more regulars than the Dutch Army.
Mm. The Dutch Army is pretty well all conscripts.
I think, and they prided themselves on having fewer. They were quite interesting, because in a way, this is another way they replicated the Americans. Their regular officers all went to their naval academy.
And then
came and did, you know, then became Marines, and they said, why don't you do that? And I said, well, what's the point in spending a lot of money training someone to be a naval officer and then having to retrain him at great expense to do his job? You know, it's just a waste of money. Mm. But anyway, that's what they did.
Do you think they had a closer sense of relationship with the Dutch Navy, which is very much the senior service in the Netherlands?
Oh yes.
More so than in Britain.
Oh, I think so. Mm. I think they had a closer, because their as I say, their sort of corporate memory was of
ships detachments.
Whereas we'd broken away from that in the First World War and in several other wars before that, and of course significantly in the Second World War and ever since. Mm. So we didn't have quite the same thing. They regard themselves very much part of the Navy then. But they're a very old corps, of course. I mean, their first battle honour is Chatham.
Yes, indeed.
Which they're very proud of.
Inordinately proud.
I mean, they're a good lot, actually. Mm. I think that they were a bit ponderous. very, very much influenced by the fact they've got a sort of trade union in Holland, a service trade union.
Well, they have, I think, three. They've got an officers' association, an NCOs association, and a conscripts union.
Yeah, which of course is divisive. Mm. So you have these three strands of. Yeah. And funnily enough, and later, when I was brigade commander in Norway, and had this Dutch battalion under command, the CO came to me and said, "I've got a problem." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "Well, my trade union rules are that if the men are away from home for longer than whatever it is, 3 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever, they have to be given a week's leave at home." Mm-hmm. And since we were there for something like 2.5 months, I said, "Well, how are you going to deal with it? Are you going to send people back, mm-hmm. trickle back them, and be always short of men, or are you going to have a sort of week where everyone rushes off back to Holland and then comes back again?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Has it occurred to you your government is spending a great deal of money sending you to North Norway to train? Do you think you're doing the right thing by sending people back, wasting even more money?" So he said, "No, but that's what the rule says." And I said, "That's all right. If you like, I will be the nasty Brit who orders you not to send them back, and you can blame me." So he said, "Oh, yes, that's a good idea." So I said, "Well, you're not to send them back, are you?" He said, "Oh, thank you very much." He went away. He didn't send them back.
And did you suffer any disadvantages as a result of being the bogeyman on this occasion?
No. No.
Was there any trouble amongst
no.
the soldiers?
No.
So they weren't?
No. I think they realised that. I said, "What you need to put over to your soldiers is your country spent a lot of money to send you here to do your Arctic training. And you're going to waste some of that money by sending people back to Holland for a week."
Presumably they could have their week when they got back.
No, I would have thought so. Yes. But it was just some silly rule, you know.
Bureaucratic
trade union type rule.
So you got the Dutch and started the process of integrating them into the... I mean, how long did you have them on Salisbury Plain for this?
Only a week.
Just a week. What happened after that? Did they go back?
Well, they went back to Holland. And then they joined us. Then they would join us for some exercises and not for others. Mm. And in fact, I didn't actually see them again on exercise until I was a CO. Oh. Because they came to us in the sort of spring of 1974, mm. and I handed over as brigade major in early 75. So for the rest of that year, though we were doing lots of other exercises, we didn't have any of that lot with us.
When you were planning exercises, how did you go about doing it? Did you get a written directive from the brigade commander, which you then put into...
Yes, the things that he wanted to do, things that he wanted practiced. Mm. And sometimes, of course, they were laid down by the people who had imposed the exercises on us, and the NATO would say, "We're going to rehearse or we're going to practice certain things," and they usually pretty standard things. Mm. But a national exercise... we would decide what we want to do. For example, we instituted a system where we volunteered to be tested by our superior headquarters because we thought it was good for us. And so our superior headquarters, which was called Commando Forces, Royal Marine Commando Forces, was detailed off to test us out. And we said we'd like to be tested in certain things because we think those are things that we should be good at. Mm. I don't mean we were good at it, but we should be good at it. Mm. And therefore we should be tried out to see if we're any good at them.
Did they usually agree with your proposals on these?
Yeah, well, they only did... The test exercise business only started when I was BM, and we only did it once, because it was meant to be done every 2 years, and we did it that year, and then I imagine it was done... and then we instituted another system, which we sort of cooked up. over a glass of something with the headquarters of what was then the 16th Parachute Brigade in Cyprus, where we undertook to test each other. So the following year, by which time I'd finished, I'd handed over, 16th Para Brigade tested the 3rd Commando Brigade headquarters, not the brigade itself, but the headquarters, when it was on an exercise.
CP procedures.
Yeah, you know, were they doing things right? Were their defence right? Were this, and then we did the same for them.
This sounds rather like a local needle match, you know, between Glasgow and Rangers and Celtic.
Sure. I mean, and it was a good idea, because what you did was you got people who had a similar sort of role. I mean, we'd be no good at all, you know, calling in a mechanised infantry brigade from Germany to do it, because they wouldn't have had the slightest idea what we were meant to be doing, and we wouldn't have had the slightest idea what they were meant to be doing, really. Mm. So you had to call in someone who had the same sort of ethos and the same sort of light approach to things.
And a history of out-of-area operators.
History of out-of-area operators to test you in these things.
Did you find in the course of those tests dealing with the 16th that they had a similar sort of mentality?
Well, it never happened in my time because I cooked it up.
Oh,
I cooked it up.
This is your legacy.
This is my legacy. I cooked it up with the brigade major, who happened to be a mate of mine on the other side, and the two brigade commanders said, "Oh, that's a jolly good idea. Make it happen," you know. Mm. So that, you know, so it did.
Right.
But that grew out of our test exercise, where we've been tested by our superior headquarters, and both of us, I think, sort of late in the evening, the BMs reorganizing the world, were sort of not happy with the rigorousness of the tests that were imposed upon us, and so we decided we'd do something about it.
What were those tests then that you thought were inadequate? Who did those?
Well, I think that what we meant was where exercises, particularly NATO exercises, which were supposed to be tests, were all demonstrations of how clever NATO was, and were not sufficiently rigorous, because they were aimed at being face-saving and preserving the sort of unity of the thing.
So the diplomatic concerns overrode the strict
absolutely,
military.
Absolutely,
Is it not a permanent difficulty in alliance?
Absolutely.
Preparations.
Absolutely, it's bound to be, bound to be, absolutely bound to be. So the only way to do it is to find someone who'll test you in a much more objective way, I think.
Yeah. So you need a friendly, challenging test.
You need a friendly, challenging test, yeah. And of course, these things are done much better now than they were, because they have these things called TESEXs, where units and formation headquarters are put through tests, which are done down... Where are they done now? There's a place that does them. I'm not sure, it isn't down at Bovingdon. Mm. But there's a place, there's a British Army set up where you can put people through people go through TESEXs, and Marines do it as well. They go through the same place.
Is this just for command posts?
This is command posts.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's the procedures and staff backup. And comms, presumably, also. Who is there an overall agency that controls that and monitors it? Or
I don't know. I have no idea, because I'm sort of out of touch with what goes on, really.
So it's evolved since
it's evolved. It's evolved.
Your arrangement was sort of local and ad hoc.
It was local, ad hoc.
Personal.
Personal, yeah.
So it sounds like you had a considerable freedom to use your initiative and to propose.
Yes, I did, because I was very lucky with my two brigade commanders who were totally different men.
Now, the first one you mentioned was this fellow...
Pat Ovens,
yes, who'd been in Korea and won the MC and was on all fours with the Americans.
Yeah.
Okay, so he allowed you a certain amount of freedom. Who was the second?
Well, the second chap was a chap who hadn't had nearly so much operational experience, who was far more uncertain of himself as a commander, I think, and tended to sort of ask more questions, though he did actually let you get on with it once he trusted you. I mean, Pat was, first of all, quite laid back.
Yes.
But pretty on the ball when it came to what mattered. And the second one was actually quite sort of uptight at times. I mean, he's a very pleasant chap. I got on with him all right. But he's one of these chaps who, you know,
He was worried about things going wrong.
He was worried about getting things going wrong, yeah.
Whereas the first one, presumably having been engaged in raiding in North Korea, wouldn't have been terribly worried by anything going wrong.
No, I mean, the time I would remember with him was in that exercise in Norway in September, October, whenever it was, a helicopter full of Dutchmen who were on this exercise went over the side into the water. I saw it happen, I mean, out there.
What happened? I mean,
what happened was they were doing something which they don't do anymore, but it was known as it was a double. The deck of a LPH has got spots on it where you take off from.
Yeah.
And if you want to cram as many helicopters as you like, you used to be able to, with a smaller helicopter, to do a thing called an 11-spot launch where you had an outer row of spots and an inner row, and there wasn't much space between the rotor blades, and it was about
six
that.
Six in one row and five in the other. Yeah. And they could take off simultaneously?
No, they took off the outer row first, then the inner row.
Ah, right.
Now, the chap in the outer row, who happened to be the senior pilot of the squadron, should have known better, forgot that he had inside him a guy here.
Oh.
So instead of taking off like that, he swung his tail in, and it was chopped off by the rotor blades of the chap alongside him, so he went over the side.
What, the helicopter lost direction, spun out
over the side. And
how many Dutchmen were they in?
Well, it was a Wessex load, so it was about 8, 9, 10 maybe.
Oh,
yeah. Luckily his flotation gear blew, deployed, so it was sitting on the surface. I remember it quite clearly. It was sort of 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, but it was light, and I could see this thing. So I went down to Pat Ovens, who's asleep, and I thought I'd better wake him up. And I said, "Oh, by the way, some Dutchmen have gone over the side. I don't know what the outcome's going to be." And he said, "Okay." Turned over, went back to sleep again. So I went up on the bridge, and they got them all out, and they were alive. And so I went back down to him, and he was genuinely asleep when I went back. And I said, "They've got him." He said, "I think what?" Went back to sleep. Well, he realised there was no point in him jumping around, rushing around on the bridge. There's nothing he, as brigade commander, to do to save those men's lives. I mean, the Navy were getting on with it. All he would do would get in the way. So he just that was his nature.
Yes. Devolution.
Yeah. And there was nothing I could do either, but I was just regarded myself. I just stood in the background, just so that I happened to be, as his representative, the first to know whether they were all dead or alive. You know, I could then tell him. But that was his nature.
Mm. And what would the second one have done?
I think he'd have been up on the bridge.
He
wasn't in charge of the naval thing, so again, there was nothing he could have done. But he'd have wanted to be up there, sort of wringing his hands and wondering if they were going to survive or not, I think.
This was on your first exercise in North Norway.
That was I'd been up in North Norway, I think, if I remember, I said years before.
Yes, but as brigade major.
But as brigade major, that was my first exercise in North Norway,
Where were you based on for that?
We stayed on board the command ship.
Ah.
We actually landed the headquarters because I wanted to practice them. But I then found that the pace was so fast of the moving, particularly the way my brigade commander played it. The only way we could keep up with the battle was by staying on board, because we could then steam the ship round to the next fjord.
Well, this is when he was using landing craft to loop round
to
another.
Exactly. So if we had landed the headquarters and then stayed ashore, we'd have then been trailing up those, we know what those roads are like, and of course they're even
serpentine, those roads.
And then they were worse then, and some of them weren't even surfaced, some of the ones. And they had a road which wasn't all that wide, going across a peat bog. And we would have just added to the traffic problem and never have got anywhere. So it's much easier to stay on board and just follow the action.
You go ashore by helicopter.
Oh, yes, you go ashore by helicopter. He went ashore by helicopter a lot. I mean, a lot of his way of working was that he was forward all the time by helicopter. Visiting COs then we had a little TAC HQ which could move quite quickly, which he could lob into if he wanted to pass a message or get on when the helicopter radio wasn't working for some reason or not, which it often didn't. And I ran the headquarters completely. and in his absence was actually running keeping the thing going. Mm. And then he occasionally would lob back in and say, well, this is going to happen, do this, do the other, get this fixed. And then he'd rush off again, and then I did it.
When they did the landings, were they all landing over beaches, or did you do operations at seas, minor port facilities? Were there any sort of cliff scaling or rock hopping?
No, it was mainly on, you know, the heads of fjords, you get these sort of shingle beaches.
Yes.
It was mainly that.
Yeah.
Or where there were little beaches at the sides, which, as you know, there are in occasional
places.
Yeah, not many. Mm-hmm. But we certainly didn't land in any of the little jetties and little fishing places that they have there. And we also tended to want to land somewhere near where the enemy was,
yes.
Which tended to be near a road.
So you'd be trying to get around their left flank all the time.
Yeah, yes. Or their right flank or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But because they tended to be on the main axes, which are the roads.
Well, there's only the E6, isn't there, on roads on
There's the E6 is, as you know, the main, and then the various roads off it, not many, which go to various settlements and things like that. We were tending to land near where they were.
Did you do any landings at night?
Oh, yes, mostly at night.
Mostly at night.
Mostly at night, yeah.
What about the Norwegian Navy? Were they involved in these?
Yes, yes. Mm. I think the Norwegian Navy were playing enemy, so their FPBs were the main threat.
Yeah.
To us, which wasn't my problem, of course. That was the Navy's problem.
Because I mean, one of the things about the Norwegian Navy, I think that over half their personnel were in placed in shore batteries
and so forth.
And presumably, they would have been expected to deny access to those beaches by bombardment.
Yes.
Was that all played into the exercise?
Yes. I don't think it was probably played as realistically as it should have been. And indeed, as far as I remember, one of the reasons for rafting up the landing craft was to deceive the radars of the batteries that these were coasters and not...
Not landing craft.
Not landing craft, yeah. Mm.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's the kind of trick you can do once or twice, and then when they twigged it, it's...
It doesn't, the
doesn't
exercise
work anymore.
The exercise didn't last that long.
Oh, it didn't last that long. Well, presumably the Russians only had to do it once. And then, probably. Yes.
But I think the Russians, you see, with superior firepower, might not have had to be so subtle.
Well, they could certainly have suppressed, or tried to suppress the shore batteries, the forts.
Yeah.
And with their habitual indifference to casualties,
they wouldn't have minded
too much anyway.
No, I mean, as you know, those batteries are quite well sighted and imaginatively sighted.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how well that bit was played, quite frankly.
Mm.
I mean, there's always an amount of unreality on exercises, and I don't remember whether they were playing those batteries as well as they might have done.
Mm. Well, they had to be fudged, otherwise you wouldn't have been able to do your landing and practice.
Quite, exactly.
Those skills.
Exactly, yeah.
How much did you know about the Russians at that time, about the local enemy and their capacities and their habits and...
Well, we studied them. We had lectures on them from I can't remember who came in. It was a school of intelligence used to come, and I think who were at
Ashford.
I think they were at Ashford in those days.
Mm-hmm.
They would come and give us lectures about the Soviet. And of course, there were numerous pamphlets, if you remember, in those days describing the Warsaw Pact army and how they were organised and what their orbat was, what their equipment was, and of course we played them endlessly in the exercises, so you got to know what their orbat was.
Mm.
I think it was later that we used to get people like Chris Donnelly down to lecture.
Mm. Peter Weigel, I think, as well in those days.
Yes.
Chris Donnelly. They used to work, didn't they, as double act.
So we definitely practice them as the enemy all the time, so we got to know what their setup was quite well. Orange forces, as they were.
Orange forces, yes. Mm. How did working with North compare with working with AF South? Were they the same sort of setup and same sort of procedures required, or was there a...
AF North tended to be more professional, I think. There were a lot of Germans in AF North, of course. And I'm just trying to think.